Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto, who, by the way, are holding the 66th annual Indiana Cave Capers this very weekend, August 2nd through the 4th at Crawford County Fairgrounds near Marengo, Indiana, home of world-famous Marengo Cave. Man, do I wish I could go, but my wife and I could be just mere hours away from welcoming our new baby boy into the world. So if you do go to Indiana Cave Capers, you may get the good news there. I actually just talked to our chairman, Rich Lunseth, today, and he said he'd love to announce the news live from the banquet stage. That'd be fun. By the way, the weather looks great. So if you're thinking about coming to Indiana for Capers, a lot of great caves on the list, including some state-owned caves that we got special permission to visit, places cavers haven't been in since the WNS closures. So it's a really special year, and there's plenty of room for everybody. Again, weather looks great. So if you want more, you can go to cigcaves.com, cigcaves.com. Go to Capers. So yeah, this is a podcast where I interview cavers, cave explorers. If you're interested in doing that yourself, find a grotto. That's a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. There you'll make friends, learn the ropes, so to speak, and get experience on how to do it safely. Caving's really fun and safe if you know what you're doing, and the opposite is true if you don't. So don't go unless you're doing it right. And if you don't know the rules, you can learn them from cavers, who will be happy to share. I'm so proud to bring you Norm Pace as my guest this month. Not only is he a caver, but he's probably most well-known as an acclaimed... we'll get to that. First off, a supporter of the show has asked me to highlight a different cave or karst conservancy every month. And this month, I'm delighted to share the one closest to my heart, the Indiana Karst Conservancy. Now, the IKC owns the very first wild cave I ever visited, Sullivan Cave. They also own Buddha Cave, Upper Twin Cave, Wayne Cave, and a number of others, a total of 7 preserves. They also manage a number of other properties with well-known caves. And I'm happy to announce that they are acquiring Lowry Cave in Jennings County, Indiana. The southeastern Indiana limestone's a little bit different. The caves it makes aren't as big, but there's a lot of fossil exposure in the walls. And Lowry Cave is a beautiful cave. Nice formations, gorgeous entrance. It's about 2,000 feet of passage. So if you want to help support the Indiana Karst Conservancy in acquiring Lowry Cave, just go to ikc.caves.org. ikc.caves.org. There you can become a member or just donate in any amount. I'll put a link in to the page on Lowry Cave in the description of this episode. You got to see this entrance. It's great. While you're there, click on that red text at the bottom to make a donation. Thank you. Okay, so Norm Pace. I got to tell you, I was a little nervous talking to Norm because he is one of the world's most important people in the fields of biochemistry, molecular biology, developmental biology. I mean, I talked to him via Skype, but I felt like I was in the presence of a legend, and indeed I was. And I kind of froze up a few times, and I didn't know what to ask, or I'd interrupt and go somewhere else. I don't know. Maybe you'll notice it, maybe you won't, but I was so anxious talking to him that it kind of got in the way a little bit, but he was still, as you'll hear, so fun and so excited to talk about caving. I mean, we also talked about his professional life a bit, which is still fascinating, at least to me. I mean, this guy, as the University of Colorado Boulder's alumni magazine, The Coloradan, put it, he blew the doors off the microbial world. There's so much that we know thanks to him, and I know this podcast is about caving, but I just want you to understand why I was so nervous talking to him, all right? It was such an honor. I promise we talk mostly about caving. Here he is. Norm Pace, thanks for chatting with us on the Caving Podcast. How are you?
Well, I am warm and upright. That's positive.
That is positive. I guess let's just go back to the beginning. You've been caving a long time. What was the first trip and what hooked you?
My history of caving went back actually, or wanting to cave, went back earlier than my first cave trip, my first real cave trip, cave trip. My parents, I had myself and two sisters, my parents used to take us to Indiana State Parks. I grew up in southeastern Indiana. And one of the state parks that we visited was McCormick's Creek State Park, which has a small cave in it, which I enjoyed. You can do a short through trip in it. But a more interesting, really, was Spring Mill State Park, which had caves in it with rivers. That's very fascinating. At any rate, and so I walked into some of these caves that were one could access readily when I was very young with just a flashlight, and you don't go very far under that circumstance. And I was about maybe 10 or 11 at the time. However, in my local library, I came across, so I was, again, 10 or 11 now, this would have been mid-1950s. I came across in the library a newly published book by Franklin Folsom called Exploring American Caves. And what Folsom did was to describe caving as it was emerging at the time. He described the National Speleological Society. He described what at that time was the trick thing, the Floyd Collins Crystal Cave Expedition, and other sorts of things that I found fascinating. And then I ran across Roger Brucker's book, The Caves Beyond, and said, boy, I want to do that. And meanwhile, I had an older person in the town I grew up in had gone to Rose Polytechnic Institute in college and had fallen in with some cavers there. And he had gotten interested in caving and got some of the local kids interested, one of whom was me. And my first cave trip was on June 22, 1956. And we went into Wayne Cave in Indiana.
That was early days of Wayne.
Yeah. And so, you know, the concept of crawling on your belly for a quarter mile, you know, that's great stuff. And I fell in love with it immediately. And along with some high school friends, continued to cave a lot in southern Indiana and then later on into Kentucky. At any rate, and then I went off to college and continued caving, and although not as heavily as previously, and then went off to graduate school and again caved, and in that case, started the Mid Illinois Grotto, and developed a bunch of good cave people that continued to cave and became well known cavers, folks like Mark Minton, for example. So then I went off into the professional world and continued caving, and by that time I caved fairly widely in Indiana and Kentucky and with various people that had caved around a lot. And then when I went to graduate school, again, caved around a lot, and then moved off to Denver to take my first job after graduate school. And there, that was kind of funny, the evolution of the Colorado Grotto was an interesting thing to see. So I arrived in Colorado in 1970. Now at that time, was it that long ago? I guess it was. At that time, the Colorado Grotto was kind of an interestingly schizophrenic grotto, in the sense that there were sort of two groups of folks within the grotto. One of them were the old, staid 1950s cavers. And in fact, the chair of the grotto when I got there was the assistant DA of Denver County.
All right. Denver
County, maybe it was. And then there was another group of people, which I tended to fall into, which sort of secretly was known as the Marmot Free Grotto. And this included the people who were really doing the caving.
Well, okay, so I'm sorry. I'm from southeastern Indiana, too. Where'd you grow up?
Edinburgh.
All right. And where'd you go to college?
Went to college at Indiana University.
Oh, well, that makes sense, the caving thing.
Went to graduate school at the University of Illinois.
Oh, okay.
And since then, I've been around a lot. I took my first job in Denver at the National Jewish Hospital and University of Colorado Medical Center. Then I moved back to Indiana University 20 years after leaving, although in this case, a full professor. And then I was there for 12 years and became a distinguished professor at IU, and then moved to Berkeley and was there for a few years. I didn't really like the East Bay, and then moved to Boulder, which is a great place to be. You haven't been here. Put it on your list.
I've been through, actually, on my way to Rocky Mountain, and it's gorgeous. It was a great day to drive through Boulder, just like almost every other day is.
Flatirons are right out my back door. I can't see them out my back window here, but.
Wow. That's something else.
So at any rate, after moving to Colorado, and I first went to a grotto meeting and met some of the people, and at that time there were supposedly monthly grotto trips. However, there sort of weren't being any then, but then I sort of agitated and one happened, and we went to a place called Cave of the Clouds, which is a pretty chicken place. And at that time, and still now, there aren't many caves, still only a few big caves in Colorado. Most of them are fairly minor. Cave of the Clouds is in Glenwood Canyon, a beautiful place to be, i.e. in Glenwood Canyon. But Cave of the Clouds itself is basically a small phreatic pocket, and frankly not very interesting. I'm not sure that the cave is much longer than 100 feet or so. I haven't been into it since that first time. I was taken into it by Peter Jones. Peter Jones, the potter, who's well known among some caving circles, excellent cave photographer. So then I got in with this group, which again alternatively was known as the Marmot Free Grotto, and caved around a lot in Colorado, notably in Groaning Cave. And then I ran the survey for Groaning Cave for a number of years during its early days, and caved in New Mexico quite a bit.
Let's go back to Indiana. As I mentioned to you in email correspondence, there is a section of Buckner Cave called the Norm Pace Extension.
There is indeed.
That upon mentioning it to you, you said, don't even bother.
No, don't. Well, you'll probably see my name carbided on the wall.
Yeah.
My NSS number, which is probably the only reason that Doug Love named it that. So as I explained to you in the email that was done about probably 1959, maybe 1960. At that time, if you look to see, it was believed that there was an inferred passage in between two breakdown rooms, the volcano room on one hand, and I forget what the name of the room was on the other hand.
The big room, yeah, because it's about the same elevation. It's the highest point in the cave.
Yeah, right. Well, in one of the early maps, there was a dotted line drawn in the inferred passage. And down where the Norm Pace extension is, there's a breakdown block, which could well have very, very well be cutting off a route up into that upper passage. And so you couldn't get in there. And so I dug through the breakdown there, and my colleagues and I dug through the breakdown and got into this chamber, maybe 30 feet long or something like that. And I dutifully smoked my NSS number on the wall, and, Doug Love, I guess, picked that up subsequently.
The infamous Doug Love and his Spelunker's Guide.
Yes, there you have. What became of him, I wonder?
Well, I think he moved to the East Coast and passed away a few years ago. But yeah, and he wrote a number of those books, I guess.
He did. Yeah. The Wheel Turns.
Yeah. Didn't do the caving community many favors in that regard.
Well, he wasn't unique.
Yeah.
There were similar sorts of things across the country. He was a bit more blatant than many. And, you know, at that time, you could buy from the Pennsylvania or from the West Virginia Geological Survey, you could buy Caves of West Virginia or Caves of Virginia or Caves of Pennsylvania, certainly. Cave lists or something that were available at that time. In fact, when I first moved to Colorado, there's a guy named, still around, I guess, Lloyd Paris, who was compiling a book to be called Caves of Colorado. And it was going to have explicit directions, just like you would see in a climbing manual, for example. And some folks would say that rock climbing has been destroyed by the various of climbing manuals, of which there are now thousands. And caving manuals began to develop that way. But the caving community, happily, pretty much shut that down just by not publishing locations and making it a bad thing to do, a positive thing in my opinion. If you ask me what the very large difference between those days and these days in terms of the caving consciousness, I would say that it's conservation. That the conservation head is so much stronger now than it ever was in those days. The conservation had began to develop, I would say, probably in the 1980s at that stage of the game, when it was already becoming clear that the impact of the local spelunkers was dramatic. Although there were, of course, efforts in the 1960s, 1970s and probably earlier, but it wasn't conspicuous.
Were you a project caver, or were you a recreational caver, a little bit of both? I mean, are there projects that you...
Yeah, no, I was most drawn to project caving, notably mapping. And, I'm a biologist, too, and one of my fortes there is mapping the tree of life, and which very much carries on from that caving background, and vice versa.
Yeah, and along those lines, there was a great article that came out in the alumni magazine, The Coloradan. It talks about not only your professional life, but also your caving life as sort of an aside, because they know you there as the microbiologist.
Yeah, that article was in The Coloradan, was written by a lady by the name of Lisa Marshall. What a pleasant woman. She very enamored with climbers, and so she was really interested in caving. she had done an article, a nice bio on Jeff Lowe, a famous local climber.
So I guess let's dart off into your professional life a little bit more. I mean, you are, when I talked to Hazel Barton, she was just, and I had known about your professional life before I talked to her, and especially, you know, your caving history in Indiana. But then when I found out about your professional life, it just blew me away. You've described so much with respect to the tree of life and microbiology in your career.
Well, I'm real happy about that.
I mean, you should be. It's changed the way a lot of people have looked at life in general.
And they give me money sometimes.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, Lisa was interested in me getting killed.
Why?
So I'd had a number of close things over the years. And the one which gets much attention, or has gotten significant attention, is getting killed in a Mexican cave.
Well,
that was a real interesting story. I don't know if you've heard it.
Well, whether I have or not, let's hear it.
Oh, it's an interesting one. Bill Steele wrote a book about it. I mean, not this particular incident, but the cave. So, Sumidero Yochip is a river cave in Chiapas. And it originally was recognized by a couple of British cavers in maybe early 70s. In the highland Chiapas is the town that people would know as a small place called Tenejapa. On the other side of the town of Tenejapa, as you come into it, is a river which runs along for a few kilometers and then essentially drills a hole through a ridge to emerge, to create the cave, Chica. And the cave emerges on the other side of the entrance to Chica, and flows through a deep karst valley to then dump underground at the small town of Yochip. Yochip is the Tzeltal word for where the water goes under. And it was pretty good water, 20 to 30 cubic feet per second, even at low water. And when it rains, there's a lot more water. At any rate, the Brits had gone in there in probably 74 or something like that, and gone into the cave some distance. And then I went in with some other folks in the first year of 1976, I guess. I'd had to review that. And so we were in the cave and getting deeper and deeper and starting to survey and so forth. And then we just finished that year, came back the following year. I'm drawing this out because I'm digging into my brain for the incident. We came back the following year. Now, the first year I was in there, you used mules to get in there, and but the Eche Varia government at the time was punching roads in everywhere, so we were one of the first motorized vehicles to get in there in that second year in 1977, I think it was. At any rate, there were a bunch of other folks involved in this. Jim Smith, Bill Steele, Carmen Soilu, Jill Dorman, a bunch of the folks doing Mexican caving at that in the mid-70s. We were a little bit limited on time because we were interdigitating with one of the San Agustin, a.k.a. Huatla expeditions at the time. and several people had commitments over there. So there was a bunch of us in there, and we were going to go in and quote bottom Yochi. And we had a big bunch of gear and a big bunch of rope and a good bunch of good group of people. Blake Harrison, Mike Van Note, good bunch of people. So the first trip in, I forget who was on the first party in, this was the rigging party. And I was on the second, leading the second party in, and we were rigging a phone line. The year before, there had been a lot of problem with flooding in the lower cave. And so we elected to put a phone line in, because it had to, in order to get communication to the surface. Because we were so deep at that stage that you couldn't just run up the surface to see whether it was raining. And when it rains in central Chiapas, this was the beginning of, you know, the early days of the potential monsoon days. So we wanted to have some communication down below. At any rate, so I was leading the party, which was Warren Anderson, and I think Carmen Soilu was on it, and who was on that? Maybe Chris Albers. And I was stringing the wire. And at one point in the cave, in that cave in Yochi, we try to stay out of the water because there's a lot of it and it's moving fast and it's high angle. But at some point, sometimes you have to get into the water. There's one particular place known as the gut where you're able to stay out of it by traversing high, about 30 feet or so higher above the stream. But then the stream drops down a waterfall, and you want to get down into the stream because the water becomes very deep and swift, and you have to get into it. And the approach is that there's a little pocket on the wall up above that gut, and there's a cable ladder that goes from that, that was rigged from the cave, from that a pocket up on the wall down to a stone bench down about 30 feet, and where you were right at the on the beach of the water. And the folks out ahead of us had rigged this stuff, and so we were rigging the phone line. Now, the drill, which we had used previously and intended to use this year, usually you wouldn't. So there was a rope running the length of the gut, which was probably 150 feet, something like that. Water moving fast. No, I don't know how deep it is. It's a canyon, about maybe 6 feet wide, and going down at high angle, but ponded. Normally, if you're in a situation like that with a rope, and you're going to follow the rope down, so a rope comes down the cable ladder and then goes through a carabiner and then out the length of the gut. So normally, you just hook your arm over that and get in the water and let it blow you off down there. There's a travertine dam down at the bottom where you could jam your feet, and then we had another cable ladder coming down. Then you climb up that cable ladder and traverse and drop down a larger pitch. So you normally wouldn't clip into a standing line, a rope going down a line like that, because the water will push you underwater. And we were all wearing wetsuits, of course, so you have plenty of buoyancy, but still the water will push you under. But I was hanging with this telephone line, and I clipped into my seat sling and had Jumar clipped into the seat sling and then clipped that into the rope running down the gut, and then so you could just kind of click the Jumar and water would blow you 10 feet back, and then I could reel out some more line and tie it up and then pull out some more line, let the water blow me down the gut again and tie up some more line and play the game again. And then all of a sudden I started picking up speed. I thought, whoa, I'm in trouble. Spit me out over the waterfall. It's about a 30-foot waterfall, something like that. Now, but I was still on the rope. I was still on Jumar. I was still on the rope with the Jumar. And so happily, my light stayed on. My pack was torn off, lost my glasses. But happily, my light stayed on. Happily. So there I was, upside down on this, hanging from my seat sling, getting whacked around real bad by the water. You know, upside down is 20 cubic feet per second water, and I couldn't breathe. And I was able to get upright. And then the water was sheeting down over my helmet, and so I could breathe. Then I was on the water kind of shot out. The water was coming out at a pretty high angle and shot out, made quite an arc. So I was on the in, hanging down on the inside of the arc. And so I realized I could, got the helmet, I could breathe and kind of bounce back against the water, and it would push me. And I was able to get over to the wall and grab a nubbin over on the wall, and was able to pull myself over and get a foot stance. And then all of a sudden, the folks up above had figured out something weird was going on, and they started pulling on the rope. What had happened is that the rope, which normally would have gone down and through a carabiner and along the gut. It was not a locking carabiner, and the rope had come out of the carabiner, and now the rope was going out transversely down the gut. I was happily, as it were, hanging out at the apex of the rope. Nothing else had broken. So these guys started pulling me, and so they pulled me off the wall, back into the waterfall, banging me up against the edge of the wall. And then they finally decided they weren't going to be able to pull me up, and then they just let go. Boom, I was back down, upside down, into the waterfall. What they thought had happened, they could see down the gut, 150 feet, something like that, and they could see my light coming up from under the water because the water arced out over the waterfall. And they could see my light coming up from below, and it looked like it was coming up from below the water. And they thought that I had been jammed underneath the... They knew what had happened as soon as they saw when that rope pulled tight from up above. They thought that I'd been jammed underneath the travertine dam down there and probably drowned. And so they tried to pull me up. That's when they pulled me off the wall. However, after I got pulled out off the wall, I then knew I could get out of it. And so I played the same game again and got over on the wall. Now, you couldn't just drop down. I couldn't do that because there was still a 20-foot drop or so down, and the water was a bad, turbulent situation. And the drain out of that pool went out over a thing called Fool's Falls, which is an 80-foot pitch. And you weren't going to come out of that alive.
No.
But it was very turbulent. So if you didn't come out of that spunky, you were going to go over Fool's Falls. So I couldn't drop down where I was, but I was able to traverse laterally and drop down in a shallow part, in a shallow still part, and then swim over and got the cable ladder that we had hanging there. We used a lot of cable ladder in Yochiv so you could move rapidly over short pitches and then ropes over longer pitches. At any rate, then when I climbed up that cable ladder and yelled, you can't hear anything in there, you know, the water's going, it's in, the wind is howling, and it's a pretty major place. And so I started shouting, and the guys up above, they thought that it was the party below that had seen a body go past. But they didn't realize that it was me, and then I was able to traverse over and get back to the where I could communicate with them. If you've read an article by Ed Yong in The Atlantic where I describe this thing, he too was more interested in the caves than the science. So I described this to Ed, and he so if you're interested, I'll send you that article. It's from Atlantic Mag.
Well, so then what came next? I mean, so you get out of that, and then what?
I wasn't much good the rest of that expedition.
No?
I had serious PTSD, let me tell you.
Is that right? So you just kind of hung back.
I was caving, but I wasn't doing it like I would have otherwise been doing it.
Yeah. How long? Was there a recovery time from that? I mean, obviously you weren't terribly injured physically or anything, but mentally you had to have been shaken up. Did you take a break after that, or were you back at it soon after?
I was back at it. I mean, you know, doing different kind of cave. At that time, I would have been back in a groaning cave and spring cave.
Yeah.
I was scuba diving in spring cave.
Oh yeah. So you've done that too.
Yeah.
Like not open air.
That's right.
But in cave diving.
Yeah. Well, I didn't do a lot of that. And Spring Cave is the other large cave in Colorado. The largest cave in Colorado currently known is Groaning Cave. Has about 12 miles surveyed, something like that, maybe 13 miles now. A guy named Derek Bristol is doing a terrific job with the remapping of that cave, which it certainly needed. And Derek's a real strong caver.
I'm talking to him next month.
Give him my best regards.
Absolutely.
From afar. Anyway, Gary, as you know, Derek's a real strong caver and a super mapper. The last cave trip I organized was in 2016. It was a cave trip called Geezers Go to Groaning. So I let the grotto people know about it, and a lot of people know about it. And a lot of the people who were involved in the mapping back in the 70s, early 70s, came. It was a lot of fun. And Derek came, and he got a little bit of mapping done. That was the first time I'd used a disto, which is great. Well, I wish I'd had one of those. I was back using a Brunton compass. At any rate, hi to Derek.
Certainly, certainly. You said the last trip you organized was 2016. When was the last time you went caving?
Went caving to go real caving. For a long time, caved pretty heavily with Cave Research Foundation in the 90s, after I moved back to Indiana in the 80s and 90s. And probably the last serious cave trip I was on was with CRF. Probably that would have been just before I moved to Berkeley, probably 1998, something like that.
Well, I've never mapped, actually. I've never been on a survey trip. I just go for fun.
Get on it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to. But I do really enjoy talking to serious cavers who do it a lot. I'm sure you've taken off work to contribute to projects, right?
Yeah. But I was lucky enough. I was usually in academic positions, and so I could pretty much cut out reasonable blocks of time and get stuff done.
Is there a cave that you'd never like to see again?
Some caves I've been in were really hard places to be, and I'm not sure I would want to go back to those. I think of one and a question, and you would ask, how could I have a horrible cave trip? Well, one cave trip, which is burned into my brain, cave situations, as you probably know, particularly when in stressful times, trips and things associated with trips get burned into your brain. One of the most closely burned into my brain is a push into a place called 20 Pound Tick Cave. It was discovered, I'm sure it was discovered by the really old trappers, but it was first discovered by cavers, by John Pollock and myself in early 1970s. It's in up on a canyon side, Clear Creek Canyon, not Clear Creek Canyon, Deep Creek Canyon, which is on the flanks of which Groning Cave sits as well. So Pollock and I were hunting around in a part of Deep Creek Canyon that hadn't really been looked at by cavers very much, and there was quite a bit of outcropping Leadville limestone there, and even the potential for a deep cave, because the influx water would have been at 10,000 feet, and the limestone outcroppings that we had eyes on and were looking at were down at around 8,500 feet, something like that. So we were bushwhacking up in that area. The place got the name 20 Pound Tick. We gave it that name because this was in June, which is high tick season, and we were whacking around in a lot of sagebrush, and sagebrush harbors ticks. And so we would stop every 20 minutes or so just to remove ticks. And it was a horrible trip because of the ticks. But at any rate, we discovered it. And at that time, this was during meltwater season. And we found this entrance. And coming out of this entrance, like a major fire hose, was this blast of water. Big blast of water. You couldn't go into it. It was a big blast of water.
Wow.
Couldn't get into any more than you could get into a fire hose. At any rate, I wanted to go back. I'm going to see that thing after the water was down. But we dubbed it 20 Pound Tick, and then John Pollock got drafted, and I was working on Groning and doing other stuff, and didn't get back to 20 Pound Tick till several years later, and 3 or 4 years later, and myself and I forget who went up there with me, maybe Tom Taylor, to have another look at it. And at that stage, the water was down enough that we could get in. And inside was a canyon which leading to a small room. And that room had a hole in the wall, a small hole. And wind was rushing out that hole in the wall like a vacuum cleaner. And I thought, geez. The hooker was that the only way on in this canyon, the canyon went on for about 20, 30 feet, something like that. And then the canyon ended very decisively. But you could see in the water down below, a canyon went off laterally, off to the right, laterally. And I'm okay, great, got to do it. I mean, you know, you weren't going to swim that free. And so, and I came back in there with probably a year later or some later time. One thing I'm sorry about, Matt, is that I never, never, ever kept a diary about any of this stuff that I've done over the years.
No, your memory's pretty good.
Well, some things get burned into your brain, like
sure.
I say. So I went back up there a few years later with, I think it was Rick Reinhart, and we were going to dive it. And one of the guys decided, this is when I was up there alone. I decided to have a look at it alone because it wasn't very far in. And it was real close to the entrance, and it wasn't going to be very long. I knew that it was open on the other side because there was air blasting out there. Something had to be opened up. And so I took two pony tanks. A pony tank is a 15 cubic foot aluminum tank. And I was using two hip mounted 15 foot cubic tanks. And that's about, if you're really cool, that's about 15 minutes of air. And that's wow. One thing that you learn very early on in cave diving is, God, this is scary. Breathe right. And I can be really scared and be breathing just cool. But anyway, which happily I could do in that circumstance. So I dropped down. I was overweighted, so I wouldn't have any problem staying too high, getting jammed up in the top of the crack, and started moving that way. I wasn't wearing fins because I wanted to keep my legs free, and started moving down that canyon, and it was crystalline in there. And this is what I have a brilliant memory of, is moving through a very narrow canyon with crystals exploding all around me, creating. Of course, low visibility,
yeah.
But happily, after only about 20 feet, I wouldn't have gone much further. The ceiling rose, and I was up out of there.
Wow.
Unfortunately, I had to go back through it. And there was the brain, because I knew it was zero vis at that stage. Zero vis. That's a tender phrase of the cave divers, which has an obvious meaning.
Was it fairly linear, though? Could you remember where
yes,
you'd been?
Yet I knew where I came up, and it was the safest solo scuba dive you can do.
Yeah, that's scary, man.
It was very scary. And after I had done a bit more diving, I would never do that again.
Another scary thing that happened to you was a terrible diagnosis not that long ago.
Yeah. Two years ago. Yeah, 2 years ago, almost exactly on March the 14th, 2 years ago, I had a seizure. And when you have a seizure, they do MRIs and CAT scans and stuff. And they discovered that I had these two big brain tumors and a bunch of little ones. And I had open brain surgery to remove the two large ones. And then what's called gamma knife surgery to hit the smaller ones that weren't accessible. And since then, I've been on the immune therapy called Keytruda, pembrolizumab. It's the commercial name is Keytruda. It's even advertised on TV.
I've seen it.
It's been spectacular. It's truly a miracle of modern science.
And without it, we wouldn't be talking right now.
We would not be.
You know, I mean, this is the caving podcast, so we should be talking about caving, but I mean, that is a real human story right there. I don't know what went through your head during that process of starting treatment and learning that it was there and to what extent.
Well, the first diagnosis that I had was from the imaging, and that diagnosis was stage 4 melanoma.
Oh.
Now, my thought at that time was, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Had I gotten that diagnosis 5 years earlier, that would have been the case. Because stage 4 melanoma, you don't survive that at that time.
Yeah.
But in 2015, the therapy that I'm getting was licensed. And it became available, essentially. And so before that, I'd have been out of here. So that's certainly one of the most fortunate situations that I've had over the period.
Well, you still got a lot of people in Indiana who remember you and love you. And when they found out...
I love Indiana.
And when a few of them found out that I was talking to you, I mean, they had heard that you had gotten the diagnosis not that long ago. But what they didn't know is that you had beaten it. You're in clinical remission. You're in remission.
There you go.
And
that just means nothing new.
Right, right, right. Nothing new. And I have a good buddy who's a survivor of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he is.
That's another one that there's good therapy for.
Yeah, exactly. And he's in clinical remission as well. And he's currently a doctor practicing in the Pacific Northwest. And but it's something you got to keep an eye on.
And be lucky.
And be lucky.
To be where and when we are.
Yeah. And so when they found out that you were in remission, because they hadn't heard in a while, they had just heard that you had gotten the diagnosis. They were ecstatic. I got to tell you, there's a lot of love for you still here in Indiana.
Well, there's a lot of love here for Indiana as well. As a matter of fact, I was there recently visiting because of an ex-student from Indiana, ex-graduate student, Esther Anger, was giving a seminar. And I enjoyed that a whole lot. And I was there in the spring also. I was so delighted. The Indiana University put in a Norman Pace lecture. And so I was doing the first of those lectures. And they gave me a distinguished professorship, honorary doctor of science. I was already a distinguished professor there. And so I was really proud and pleased to be there.
So you spent a little bit of time there recently. I mean, when you go there, do you ever just drive on Garrison Chapel Road and hit up the car stereo?
Yes. Yeah. Go back and have a look at Dade on Wayne, smell the cave.
Attaboy. I like that.
Well, my wife has a house there as well, and she's along the mainstay of High Flyers Trapeze, High Flyers Family Circus, which I don't know if you looked up any of that stuff.
A little bit. Fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And so she's still running a full-fledged trapeze there and heavily involved with it through that as well, which I'm pleased about. It's a wonderful thing.
Do you watch Derek Bristol's videos, the caving vlog that he does?
I have not, but you've sparked me to do so.
Well, and that brings me to this question. You being in the microbiology world, did you ever get a chance to go to Lechuguilla?
Yes.
You did? All right.
Yeah. I was the first party into the Great Western Borehole.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a rich cave in Colorado, caver lore.
That's Colorado cavers have heavily been involved in that, notably Donald Davis.
Yeah, yeah.
And
he wrote so much on Lech.
He has. Donald is for my money, Donald Davis is one of the best cavers ever, and certainly one of my best caving friends ever. I've done a lot of stuff with Donald, a lot of places.
Was any of your work featured in that book that they wrote, Deep Secrets?
No reason to. I was on one of the very early trips into there. And I was there in late 80s, maybe 1987, shortly after the discovery. And I was with, I forget who else was on this party. We were directed to go off way in hell, off down somewhere, and off a breakdown pile, there was this what looked like be a large lead leading down there. Go have a look at that. That was the Great Western Borehole. New cave was easy to find in Lechuguilla at that time.
Yeah, indeed.
So Donald Davis has certainly been one of the real drivers of that cave over the decades now.
Yeah, indeed. And I've read that book, Deep Secrets, twice now, and I've grown to appreciate, obviously all the Lechuguilla cavers and not just from the earlier days, but of late, and I've gotten to talk to a lot of them, via this podcast, but, it's pretty cool that you were in there right after the genesis of the project.
That was if you ask me about most favorite cave trips, which you did, I would certainly put that one high on my list. That place to see a place. Have you been in there?
No, I haven't personally.
To see a place like that for the first time, having been by far and away mostly familiar with the usual kinds of caves.
Right.
To go into something like Lechuguilla for the first time. And I've already done stuff like Virgin Cave and stuff like that, you know, some of the other crystalline sorts of New Mexico caves, but that place is just eye knockout.
Well, and all of the science that's been done in there too. I mean, were you involved in any of that, or were you just involved in the exploration?
No, I follow the science in the sense that there are two kinds of science in there. One is the geology, the formation of the cave,
of course,
I was involved in that scientifically only insofar as talking with Donald Davis at that time. Donald was really one of the first people to come up with the concept of sulfur and sulfuric acid origins of Lechuguilla Cave and Carlsbad and the other Guad's caves.
Sure.
Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, yeah, where it formed from the bottom up, essentially.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what came into the caves was reduced, and then as it encountered oxidation and microbial activities, then the sulfide, which is how it came in, goes to sulfate, i.e. sulfuric acid. So it's a sulfuric acid solution, which explains a lot of the character of the caves and so forth. And the fact of that Donald was always marveled at was the occurrence in so many of the Guadalupe's caves of amorphous gypsum, large amounts of deposits of amorphous gypsum. How could that happen? That was always Donald's question. And he troubled over how that could have happened. And so one of the possibilities that we discussed at the time was the possibility of microbial oxidation of sulfide coming in from the geothermal fields to the east of the Guadalupe Mountains. And that's pretty much what turns out to be the case. Both chemical oxidation is undoubtedly with microbiological oxidation as well. And of course, a lot of gypsum, calcium sulfate in the groundwater saturating the rock, resulting in all that wonderful crystalline stuff. I was involved in hydrothermal vent science and dived in Alvin to do that kind of stuff. And you know, the Woods Hole submersible.
Did you really?
Yes.
That's cool.
And, well, there was interesting biology on that. And one of the interesting things about submarine vents is that there's a lot of hydrogen sulfide coming out of most of them. Now, there's a lot of microorganisms that can use hydrogen sulfide as an energy source if there's oxygen around. And there's a lot of oxygen. There's oxygen, low oxygen levels on the ocean floor. But around submarine hydrothermal vent areas, which are the ones that have been explored, are in the typical 2 to 3 kilometer depth. That's one reason I was doing this project, was I always wanted to get a ride in Alvin and was able to do so.
You and me both, buddy. That's great.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But at any rate, what I was down there was to get worms.
Yeah, the tube worms.
Big tube worms, yeah. Well, now the big tube worms were just discovered in late 1960s, and it wasn't recognized until the late 1970s that these things didn't have any mouth, gut, or anus. What they had is an inner bag called a trophosome, which is very heavily colonized by bacteria. What happens is the bacteria take in the sulfide from the surrounding vent waters and oxygen from the surrounding waters and carbon dioxide from the surrounding waters, and they use the hydrogen sulfide as an energy source to make low molecular weight organic compounds, which are used to feed the worm. So the worm is basically a bag of bacteria, or a home for the bacteria. So when these things were first discovered, like the symbiosis was first reported, I think, in 1979 maybe. When that was first discovered, my lab had been working on now for a few years. Well, when we first got started on this vent stuff, had been working on for a few years. We had gotten involved in developing, trying to think of a simple way to say this. We'd gotten involved in what I'm best known for microbiologically is using molecular methods to identify organisms in the environment without culture. Now, it turns out that before that development, and this basically involved in getting out ribosomal RNA or ribosomal RNA genes from organisms in the environment and analyzing sequences, nucleic acid sequences of those molecules. And from those sequences, we could infer what was the nature of the microorganism with regard to other organisms that were known. We first started doing this stuff in the early 1970s and discovered very rapidly that what we knew about the natural microbial world was a very small slice of what was really out there.
Yeah.
And that's what blew the door off the microbial world, as it were. Which Hazel probably used that term. I'd been doing this for a while and had gotten some repute for it. And so when I made inquiries about getting access to trophosome material from worms, I could get it. And so I was interested at that time. We'd been doing a lot of Yellowstone microbiology, and at that time the lab was engaged in looking for the highest temperatures for life. And we were working in Yellowstone up to the boiling temperature of water in Yellowstone, which is 92 degrees centigrade at that elevation. And we'd already picked up lots and lots of new stuff up near boiling. And the question was, how high could it go? And over the course of a decade, we had a series of dives, both with Woods Hole subs and also with the Japanese subs, to put in situ culture chambers that we made on submarine hydrothermal vents in a number of places in the world. That's a much longer story. And I forget how we got into it. But this was going toward a cave. and the cave that it was moving toward was Parker's Cave in central Kentucky. So I'd gotten interested in that period in the early 80s. I'd gotten interested in this. We'd started developing this project, this molecular project, in the early 80s that began to blossom. And at the time, I was doing a lot of caving in Kentucky and met some folks at CRF that were familiar with Parker Cave. Do you know the place?
I don't know, no.
My question to my colleague cavers at the time was, do you know of any caves around that have sulfide streams in them? You know, it's not uncommon in Indiana and Kentucky to find sulfide-containing streams. Now, it's an interesting question. Where does the sulfide come from? The sulfide, because with just exposure to oxygen for not very long, it'll be oxidized to sulfate. So what I was looking for was a sulfide cave. What I was really looking for was an analog for submarine hydrothermal vent, sulfide-driven microbiology that was more accessible than a submersible. Now, and so what do you find at submarine hydrothermal vents? Well, there are lots of springs and stuff around in Indiana associated with a lot of microbiology, but they're all out in the light. And so I wanted to find sulfide sources in the dark, because that's what it's like at submarine hydrothermal vents. There's no light down there. A lot of sulfide, no light, but a lot of microbiology. So that's what I was looking for, is analogs for submarine hydrothermal vents and possibly invertebrate models for things like Riftia pachyptula, the worms. And there are other creatures of that character. So I was asking that of cavers for sulfide-containing caves. And I forget, somebody, Don Coons probably, pointed out Parker's Cave. He and some other folks had surveyed that a number of years early when they were doing a lot of surveying in that area. So Don took a group of us in there to look around in Parker's Cave. And indeed, Parker's has four levels. It's a drainage system. It's near Mammoth Cave. And there are overflow tubes into these different levels, these four different levels. And as you drop down into one of them, which had been dubbed Sulfur River, you can immediately smell the sulfide. Huh. And so you can then follow upstream, and then before long you're into pretty robust microbial mats, slimy microbial mats. And so we had first gone in there and seen those things. Don Coons, I think it was, took us down there. Might have been Rick Olson. And so we went down there and a lot of microbiology down there. And we did subsequently go back, take samples, did some microscopy, did a little bit of molecular work on them, but that was an early day of the molecular work, and published a paper on it, but it wasn't nearly as dramatic as we could have done now. I never got back to do a more elaborate development. There's not much money in cave microbiology. Hazel well knows well.
Yeah, but it is a forced marriage of your two passions, so it only makes sense that you and she would be the people to do it.
No, Hazel and I have a lot in common.
I do have one final question, but it's kind of a silly one. This is the question that I try to ask everybody, and most people can't give me an answer, and it makes sense why. But if you could possibly say why you like caving. I mean, it's been a thing for you for over 60 years, so it's probably hard to answer, but...
No, particularly at the time that I got involved in caving, finding new cave was really easy. it's hard now.
Hmm.
And I think that's one reason that caving has turned, essentially for most people who get into caving early, their early days of caving are more likely to be invested in conservation and touring than it is in doing new cave, going out and finding new cave. In those days, going out and finding new cave was the game. So discovering new things was a very credible possibility. So the goal of discovery was very much on the table. And the goal of mapping cave was very much appealed to my brain of order. So,
so that was it. Fine. That was why.
You ever walk across a, or better yet, crawl down a passage that hasn't been touched since the Pleistocene?
Not
footsteps.
Not personally.
I just flashed on a place in Mammoth Cave where, you know, Mammoth Cave, there was saltpeter mined in Mammoth Cave. And part of the saltpeter process that they were using involved in burning a lot of fires in the cave to evaporate peter dirt leachate. And so the historic parts of Mammoth Cave are heavily covered with soot all over the place. One memorable cave trip I went on, in CRF cave trip, I think it was Richard Zoff and Tom Brucker and myself went somewhere, went out Mystic Avenue, one of the historic areas in the historic Mammoth Cave. And Tom Brucker had found a canyon off there that had led up to a cross passage that we were going to go up and map. And so I had climbed up that canyon and went off down to check out that passage. It was maybe 20 feet high and stoop walk, hands and knees, stoop walk high. And the floor was jet black, except wherever I would step, it would burst into white gypsum sand.
Oh.
And the black was, of course, deposited by the miners in the early 1800s.
Yeah, yeah.
And these were the first steps, black steps turning brilliant white. I remember that. You know, some things get burned into your brain. I remember that one.
How could you not? That's incredible. Well, hey, that's a great place to wrap up unless you got anything else you'd like to share.
Nope. Get out and go caving.
Well, Norm, I really appreciate you taking the time, and thanks for coming on, and keep at it. We're all thinking about you in Indiana.
Well, I'm for it, Matt, and I'm thinking of them, too. And just in general, the caving experience over the long years, heavily involved and not so heavily involved, but always following, my engagement with the caving community has certainly been one of the highlights of my life.
And talking to him was quite a highlight for me. I hope it was as much for you listening. And hey, thanks for listening. Support the podcast by supporting caving. You can donate to this month's featured Karst Conservancy, the Indiana Karst Conservancy, by clicking the link in the description. You can also support past sponsors like Organic Robot on Etsy. I think Charlie will be at Cave Capers this year too, in Indiana, at least I think, which again is this weekend, August 2nd through the 4th at Crawford County Fairgrounds. Swago is a sponsor of the podcast at one time. Visit swagogear.com. Thanks as always, Scott. Give to your grotto, give to the NSS, and thank you. I almost forgot. Next month is Christine Walkie of SCCI. We talk about their big annual event coming up in September, so what better time to have her on? Look for that September 1st. I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto, soon to be father of two. Until next time, kill nothing but time.